With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Edwards with a lay, Donovan Edwards, down the sideline, gets past Ransom, Donovan Edwards, touchdown, Michigan.
We didn't touch on any of the college football yesterday, and with Denton, it's fun to have these conversations because Denton's as big of a college football fan as I am. And so we've been doing this on Tuesdays, and this will be the last Tuesday. Well, no, we'll do it next Tuesday as well because we'll have conference championship weekend to talk about. But the Michigan-Ohio State game on Saturday, Denton, was, I think, as pumped up for me pregame to watch a game as I felt in a long, long time for an NFL or college game. It felt so big going into it. And I'm going to give you the number one reason why. It wasn't just because they were both 11-0 and this was for a playoff spot for sure. This was for a Big Ten title game appearance. It's because for the first time in a long time, Ohio State was in revenge mode. I consider Ohio State's football fan base to be maybe number one in terms of the most passionate sports fan bases in our country. I mean, we could have a debate about that, and you write that one down. One of these days, we should, you know, kind of rank the fan bases in any of the sports. I think Ohio State's football fan base may be the number one passionate fan base in all of American sports. And to see them in the mode they weren't an underdog. They were an 8.5-point favorite. But after losing last year in Ann Arbor for the first time in a while to Michigan, and in this rivalry, you know, it's all about you got to sit there for 365 days before you get another opportunity. They were the bloodthirsty, revenge-driven team. That place was lit. I had one of my best friends, who's a big Ohio State guy, at the game. He's sending me pictures before the game. He said it's the most electric environment he's ever been in at the Shoe in Columbus. And you could sense that during the pregame shows. You could sense that right before kickoff, that Ohio State wanted blood for last year. And that made it for me going into it. I'm going to be honest, I was rooting for Michigan. I played Michigan plus the points. They were not a smell test pick, but I told you last week, I really thought Michigan had a chance. I've been saying it for a few weeks, but not for the reasons that they won the game. I was dead wrong. I thought they had a chance to win the game because with Blake Corum, who was hurt, you know, and came out after basically his second carry of the game, one of the best running backs in the country. So they did it without their debatably best player on their team. I thought that they'd be able to run it down Ohio State's throat, control the ball, you know, and win, you know, 27 to, you know, 23, that kind of a game. It wasn't the way it played out. Ohio State loaded the box, stopped the run, and up 10-3. In the first quarter, and having Michigan in a 3rd-and-9 situation, Michigan came up with the play of the game, in my opinion. It was the all-out zero-coverage blitz on 3rd-and-9, and J.J. McCarthy, who, if you had told me, has to beat Ohio State with his arm before the game, I would have said, this is going to be ugly. It's going to be 45-10. And he threw a hitch to Cornelius Johnson, slipped the tackle, and went 70 yards for a touchdown. 10-10, game on. Fine line in these games. Ultimately, Michigan kicked Ohio State's backside in the second half and in the fourth quarter. But without that third and nine hitch against that all-out blitz and basically man coverage, and that ball got out on time, it got out there with zip, and then Johnson slipped the tackle and went the distance. And that was, for me, the play of the game. Without it, I think Ohio State takes a 17-3 lead, and the route might be on. But it wasn't, and then Michigan, every time against the loaded box, they threw it deep, and then they converted deep. One big play after another, and then in the second half, they came back, and they ran it down their throat. And without their best running back, Donovan Edwards comes in, and he has a 75 and an 85-yard touchdown run in the fourth quarter and finishes with 216 yards rushing. And Michigan wins the game 45-23. There is nothing – I was talking to Stanford Steve about this yesterday on my podcast. There is nothing more thrilling than a road win against a team in a hostile environment like that in any sport. You see it more in college sports, but hell, you saw it last year with Cincinnati going to Tennessee and winning in the postseason, Cincinnati going to Arrowhead and winning in the AFC Championship game. There's something so thrilling about seeing a team in an unbelievably hostile environment in a big game as the road team by themselves deliver. And Michigan delivered in a big way. Jim Harbaugh, who Michigan fans wanted out basically, you know, 375 days ago, said that's it. If he doesn't beat Ohio State, we're done with him. Now he's won back-to-back over Ohio State. He's going to his second straight playoff, and they love Harbaugh. What did you think of the game?
I was similar, I think, to you, whereas I thought if Michigan was going to win, they had to run the football. But like, I think hindsight is 20-20 now, Kevin. I almost feel like, in a way, that Michigan was kind of hiding J.J. McCarthy, if that makes sense. Because they picked him over McNamara because of this talent. Like Jim Harbaugh, he's like five-star. They saw this all-worldly talent. And you look back at some of the games they played throughout the course of the regular season, it's not necessarily that J.J. couldn't throw. They just didn't ask him to. So it almost like weirdly felt like they were hiding it, and they knew there was going to be a moment where it would work in their favor. Now, I don't know if Harbaugh is smart enough to say this is what we're going to do, and it's going to be against Ohio State, and he's going to throw for three touchdowns, three of which are over 50 yards. Maybe he wasn't thinking that. But they knew they had that in him all along, and they just kind of waited for the right time to unleash it. I would almost wonder, like, do you think based off of that performance and seeing now that J.J. McCarthy can throw the football and that now we know he can throw the football, that the committee is thinking in their hotel room in Dallas, should Michigan be number one?
Ooh, I have not thought about that, but it's interesting, and I want to save that thought when we get to, you know, this part of the conversation where we're talking about the playoff, because I'll just tell you right now, I think Georgia's been unimpressive recently, but that's interesting. Will the committee say, well, he was playing possum with McCarthy all year long in his ability to throw the ball and the ability for Michigan to be really explosive offensively in the pass game. So now we have to consider that. I don't know. Maybe. Because I'll tell you what, I can't believe Ohio State continued to load the box and come after him and sit in man coverage. Like, it's not like Michigan doesn't have big-time athletes. Like, at some point, you know, when they got burned over and over again on some of these deep throws, you know, it was the 69-yarder was a hitch, but they had the 75-yard touchdown pass in the first half, the 45-yarder to the tight end in the third quarter. Like, enough already. You're going to have to try to play the run with, you know, your front seven or your front six. But they just kept coming, and he kept burning them. And then in man coverage with the box loaded on some of those short yardage third downs, once Edwards got through there, by the way, he was injured too, you know, and he just broke through, and it was, you know, a foot race, and it was gone. It was kind of, I don't know, as a sports fan, watching Michigan do that to Ohio State, there's just something I love. This time of year, too, especially when we get into the NFL playoffs, I love watching road teams that are underdogs, and in some cases big underdogs, give it a real run against the home team. That's why Cincinnati's, you know, win at Tennessee last year. By the way, with Joe Burrow getting sacked, what was it, 10 times or 9 times?
9 times, yeah.
Yeah, and that, you know, and then winning at KC, which nobody does really except for Brady that one time. Michigan was impressive, really impressive. Let me just tell you, though, on Saturday, what I thought was the most impressive win of the day, Denton. Everybody's been, you know, referring to TCU's undefeated record as lucky. You know, they had overcome a 17-point deficit to beat, you know, Oklahoma State, 18 points or whatever it was against K-State. You know, they had all of these close games, including the, you know, fire drill field goal to beat Baylor last week. Iowa State, for those of you who don't know, is one of the best defensive teams in the country. They just have struggled offensively all year long. But, you know, they gave up only 14 in a loss to Texas Tech, only 20 in a loss to Oklahoma State. They held, you know, Oklahoma to 13, West Virginia to 14, K-State to 9, Kansas back in the earlier portion of the season when they were rolling to 11 points. Iowa State's been lights out defensively, and TCU shredded them. They scored 62. Now, they did have two defensive touchdowns, but they could not be stopped at all on offense. TCU is, and they did it without their best receiver, Quentin Johnson, who's going to be a first-round pick, a top half of the first-round pick. TCU's 62-14 win over Iowa State, to me, was the most impressive result of the weekend. And I think that TCU is in unless they get blown out by Kansas State. I think if they lose, if it's close and competitive, they have earned their way into the top four. And I think a lot of what they did to Iowa State on Saturday, you know, will carry the day because it's their first blowout performance in a while, and they did it against one of the best defensive teams in that league and in the country. TCU's, would they be a double-digit underdog against Alabama? Yes. Would they be a double-digit underdog against Ohio State? Probably. But that's not what the playoff formula is about. It's not about what the Vegas line would be. TCU, with their 12-0 regular season record, has earned their way in unless they completely soil themselves in the Big 12 championship game against a very good K-State team. Give me the performances other than Michigan's from Saturday that impressed you the most.
I was really, really impressed. Well, one had no business on the playoffs, but Oregon State doing what they did to Oregon without throwing the football, I thought was amazing.
Tell everybody what they did, because I had Oregon State in the smell test, plus 3.5. By the way, I do know that that game went to like plus 1 and even pick 'em before the game. I watched this. Tell everybody what happened.
So I, for the life of me, I have no idea what Dan Lanning was doing, but Oregon State overcame what was it, 31-10? It was 31-10 in the fourth quarter to beat Oregon in a rivalry game, and they did so like throwing the ball 6 times. They were running the football. They dared Oregon to stop them. They had a little bit of help from Dan Lanning deciding to go for it on fourth down in his own territory. I don't disagree necessarily with the move. I don't know if I love the play call, knowing that Bo Nix, which that's who they ran it with. They ran it with Bo Nix on a fourth down. I don't agree with that, considering he had a little bit of a bad ankle. But Oregon State beat their rival, overcoming a multi-touchdown deficit in the fourth quarter, and they barely threw a single pass in the entire quarter. It was one of the more ridiculous things I think I've seen in college football, but it's one of the reasons why you and I are so infatuated with it, because you just don't see that normally.
Let me just make sure that I add to that. It's not that they barely threw the ball. They did not throw the ball one time after falling behind 31-10, and they won the game 38-34. They did not score a defensive touchdown, although there was a dropped punt and there was a fumble deep in their own Oregon's territory, which created short fields. But down 31-10, all right, 31-10, they came back and won a game 38-34 without throwing the football one time. Their overall passing stats, as you mentioned, 6 completions for 60 yards. But that all happened before they fell behind 31-10. And in part because there were 2 interceptions on the dude's 13 attempts. They came back by exclusively running the football and then getting a turnover and getting a short field after a fourth down miss and having a punter drop the snap at their at their own goal line. Okay, all those things happened. But they did not run. They did not throw the football once. I don't think we'll ever see that again. I don't know that we've ever seen it unless it was triple option football, service academy football. But I don't think a team down 31-10 has ever come back to win a game without throwing the football. I have to imagine that's if somebody goes back. I didn't see it written, but they did not throw the football one time down 31-10, and they won the game 38-34. What you said about Dan Lanning, the coach of Oregon. Oregon finishes the season 9-3. Against Washington a few weeks ago at the end of regulation in a 34-34 game, and their starting quarterback, Bo Nix, hurt and on the sideline, they went for a 4th-and-1 from their own 33-yard line with a minute to go in the game with their backup quarterback, and they were stopped, and Washington kicked a game-winning field goal. They were already in field goal range after they got the stop. You've got, by the way, with your starting quarterback not out, but just out for a few plays in that series, and it looked like he was going to have a chance to come back in for the overtime. So you punt the ball. If you lose, you make them go the length of the field for a field goal. You don't hand them the ball at the 33-yard line. And then on Saturday, against Oregon State from his own 29-yard line with a 34-31 lead, he went for 4th-and-1 and got stopped again against a team that had all the momentum in the world. And to me, Dan Lanning, the coach of Oregon, is the biggest analytics, fourth down analytics sucker of the year. He basically cost his team a playoff spot or a chance at a playoff spot in the championship game they would have been in against USC this Saturday. Insane decisions. I talked about it in the Washington game, and the other day it was just as dumb. They had the lead. That was crazy. Let's continue this conversation because there's one other game that I want to talk about because I think it cinched the Heisman Trophy for a Gonzaga Purple Eagle quarterback who now plays out in Southern California. And then we'll get to the playoff conversation when we come back. Kevin Sciancho, Team 980 and the Team 980.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Come.
Williams has time against the four-man rush. Backpedaling, scanning, now running out of time. Circling back. Joystick on the move again. Are you kidding me? Williams dancing, cutting, mesmerizing run by the quarterback, finally dragged down at the 20. It's a highlight reel tonight.
He did the Heisman pose earlier. If he wants to do the Heisman pose after this play, I'm okay with it.
Caleb Williams, awesome for USC on Saturday night in the Coliseum, a Coliseum that was packed for Notre Dame and a game that USC had to win to enhance their playoff possibilities. And Caleb Williams, for all intents and purposes, Caleb Williams from the D.C. area, played at Gonzaga, went to Oklahoma, picked Oklahoma over Maryland, and went with Lincoln Riley to Southern California. Has, I think, wrapped up the Heisman. The odds are overwhelmingly over Max Duggan and a couple of other people. C.J. Stroud lost his opportunity Saturday. Williams was 18 of 22 Saturday night in the Coliseum for 232 yards and a touchdown throwing. He had 9 carries, 35 yards, and 3 rushing touchdowns. He's like right now at BetMGM, right now he's minus 2,500. So he is a lock to win the Heisman Trophy. Congratulations to him. I guess he could go out and have a terrible game on Friday night against Utah in the Pac-12 championship game, and Duggan could have a great game for TCU, but I think he wrapped up the Heisman. I will say this. Notre Dame was right there. You know, they had the 2 turnovers in the second half. They're driving to start the second half down 17-7. By the way, I bet Notre Dame. I didn't give them out as a smell test pick, but I bet Notre Dame plus the 6. They're driving, and the quarterback fumbles, you know, deep in USC territory. That could have been 17-14. They were down 31-21, and they, you know, they threw an interception. They had chances, certainly to cover anyway, and they didn't get it done. But USC gets to 11-1. I did want to mention just 2 other games from Saturday. You know, Our belief that Clemson was not a very good team all year long was really wrapped up and packaged up nicely on Saturday. Now, I gave Clemson out. That was one of the few losses I had this weekend. I just thought they were giving too big of a number to a team that had annihilated Tennessee the week before. By the way, congratulations to Shane Beamer, Frank Beamer's son, and the incredible job he did at South Carolina. He eliminated 2 playoff teams in the final 2 weeks of the regular season, eliminating Tennessee 63-38. And then on Saturday, rallying rallying from 14-0 down and a 9-point halftime deficit to beat Clemson 31-30. I have no idea what Dabo was thinking leaving DJ in there. The dude was 8-for-29 for 99 yards and an interception. He was terrible. This was the problem with Clemson. We've seen Denton since the beginning of the year. They did not have a good enough quarterback. How do you leave him in there and not bring the freshman in there when he is 8-for-29? That's beyond me. Spencer Rattler, how about the way he finished up? But Clemson losing, it was good to get them out of there. And then LSU losing to A&M. This game was 17-17. LSU was coming back. They had the ball, and Jaden Daniels fumbled on a read option keeper, and it was picked up and run back for a touchdown, and that changed it all. It's disappointing for me because I would have loved to have seen LSU this weekend against Georgia with a playoff spot on the line for LSU because I thought they were really playing good football. A&M treated this like the game of the year. I mean, after nobody was in their stadium a week before against, who was it, UMass? Who did they play the week before where you had the stadium shots of basically nobody in the crowd? I think it was UMass.
One of those layup games that the SEC always schedules before the big games.
Yeah. And it was packed and raucous, and they were really good defensively, and their running back ran for 200-plus yards. So LSU and Clemson were both eliminated from the playoff race on Saturday. I mean, if Clemson wins that game, they lost 31-30. I hate to say it, but we're sitting here talking about them being a win over North Carolina away from it being, you know, perhaps a playoff spot or certainly a debate with USC. So let's get to it. I think it's really easy when we get the rankings tonight. It's Georgia. Now, you made the case for Michigan earlier. That's an interesting case. I'll let you make it here in a second. But I think it's Georgia, Michigan, TCU, and USC. I mean, those are the four teams. If you want to put them in an order of Michigan, Georgia, TCU, USC, have at it. But I think we'll see Georgia, Michigan, TCU, and USC as the top four tonight. And then what will be key is who is number five, Ohio State or Alabama. I think it'll be Ohio State, one loss versus a two-loss Alabama team, even though those two losses were by a grand total of 4 points. The problem is they needed LSU to win against Texas A&M, and they lost. So LSU's going to drop. And Tennessee, even though they blew out Vanderbilt, they've got the two losses there. But I think Ohio State will be five, Alabama will be six, which will be crucial because if somehow you see Bama move ahead of Ohio State, whoever's five tonight is the first one in if USC loses to Utah on Friday night, which, by the way, they're only a 2.5-point favorite to avenge their only loss of the year. Utah's very capable of winning that game, one of the best coached and one of the toughest teams in the country. So it's those four in that order, in my opinion. If, you know, Georgia and Michigan obviously don't have to win. They're already in. TCU, I don't believe, has to win. I think a blowout loss is the only thing that could eliminate them from the field. If they were to get hammered 45-17 by K-State, I think that could be a problem for TCU as a one-loss team against a one-loss Ohio State in a comparison. I think the one team that absolutely has to win is USC. If they don't, I think Ohio State's in. If TCU gets hammered and USC loses, then maybe Ohio State and Alabama are both in. And by the way, in that scenario, and maybe even in the scenario where USC loses and TCU loses a close game, it's possible Ohio State could be in as the 3 seed, setting up a rematch with Michigan in a semifinal in Arizona, I guess, that would be played in. But how do you see it? I mean, those are the 6 teams with a chance. Nobody else. Tennessee doesn't have a chance. Obviously, Clemson and LSU were eliminated. I actually think Penn State's probably one of the best 4, 5, or 6 teams in America, but they don't have a chance. How do you see it?
Well, I do just want to say if that Ohio State situation happens and they get a rematch against Michigan and they lose, Ryan Day would never be allowed back in Columbus. Like, they wouldn't even be able to go back and get his things from his homes. They'd ship it to him. They'd just leave him there. I don't think that Michigan is going to be number one tonight, But I do think the committee is kicking around the idea because Georgia has been kind of boring for the past few weeks.
Agreed.
They beat Tennessee, but you and I think both agree they should have destroyed Tennessee. And they beat them by 14 because Kirby got conservative. And you look at something like they beat Georgia Tech. I mean, surprise, surprise. Georgia
it was 10-7 at halftime, though.
Right. So if the committee cares about game control, I don't know how that works. That's like continuation in basketball. It works for some people. It doesn't work for other people. But if they care about game control, they look at that. They beat a Kentucky team 16-6. Kentucky is not good, Kevin. They're not a good football. I mean, they're like average at best. You look at who Georgia's beaten. The Tennessee win is probably the best win of the entire season. I get that. And they beat Oregon to start the season. But just on the way they finished their season compared to Michigan, who now has a fully rounded out offense with J.J. McCarthy being able to throw, I think you at least have to float the idea that potentially Michigan is the best team in college football.
You know, I didn't even think about it, but you're right. Michigan's resume is a better resume than Tennessee's. Their wins, their blowout wins over Penn State and Ohio State are trump Georgia's one solid win, which was the win over Tennessee. And, you know, the Oregon win to start the season, with Oregon losing twice in the last three games, that takes the luster off that a little bit. Michigan's resume, despite their weak non-con schedule to start the season, which included games against, I think it was Hawaii, and was it Colorado or Colorado State? I think it was Colorado State.
Colorado State.
They ended up beating UConn, who ended up having a good season. But yes, I agree with you. It's really an interesting thing to bring up because I wonder if on the selection show tonight, anybody else will consider whether or not Michigan should jump Georgia for number one. Now, they did not in any of the two polls. You know, the AP and the coaches poll both had Georgia 1, Michigan 2. But their resume with the two wins over Penn State, who, by the way, is a hell of a football team. Penn State lost to Michigan and Ohio State. They led Ohio State in the fourth quarter. Remember that. They crushed everybody else on their schedule. Everybody. I mean, they destroyed teams this year. You know, a Minnesota team that I think was, I mean, wasn't Penn State barely even favored in that game over Minnesota? Destroyed them. Destroyed Maryland. Destroyed Indiana. Destroyed Michigan State. On Saturday. Actually, that was a little bit closer in the fourth quarter. They crushed Auburn, who wasn't any good. Understood. They beat, by the way, on the road in the opener, right? Wasn't this the Labor Day weekend Friday night game when they beat Purdue, who's in the Big Ten championship game against Michigan? So that's an interesting case. So, all right, whatever the order is, Michigan, Georgia, or Georgia, Michigan. You got TCU and USC right now, 3-4, I assume, right?
Yes, yeah.
So what has to happen Saturday for Ohio State or Bama to get in?
I agree with you that USC, if they lose, they're out,
yep.
No matter what. The TCU thing I think is interesting because I think they can still get in with a loss, like you had mentioned, but I wonder what the leash is. Like, what constitutes a blowout? If they lose by 10, is that too much for the committee? Does it have to be a one-score game? Can they lose by potentially 12? Like, I'm curious as to what that number is that the committee would say, no, we can't let them get in with this kind of loss, but we will accept a loss of this
magnitude.
I think
it's domination. I think it's, you know, we watch the game Saturday at noon, and K-State's in control from the jump throughout, and they win 35-14. And TCU never has a chance. I think that becomes a problem for TCU. Anything else, you know, 20-10, then it's 20-13, it's a one-score game going into the fourth quarter, but they end up losing, you know, 34-20 or something like that. You know, if they've got a chance to win that game and they lose, I think they're in. I think that their regular season was... And by the way, the eye test recently, to me, they pass it. Again, the would they be favored over Ohio State or Alabama? I don't like that conversation a lot of the time because it's too heavy on odds makers and not on, you know, what kind of season they ultimately had. They wouldn't have a conference championship, nor would Ohio State or Alabama. And both Bama and Ohio State would be double-digit favorites over TCU. There's no doubt about it. Hell, Michigan, if they play TCU in one of the semifinals, is going to be, you know, a 10-point favorite over TCU, right? 7-10, yeah. Somewhere in that range.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
But I think they're in, personally, with a loss as long as it's not a one-sided beatdown loss.
And
you agree that Ohio State would be the first in if SC loses or TCU gets hammered?
Yeah.
Over Bama?
I think so. I was trying to like make a case for Bama in my head, but at a certain extent, like the losses do have to matter. I mean, that's why we play the game. So I do think Ohio State would have the advantage over Alabama.
Yeah, it's the one loss, in your opinion, maybe, and maybe in the committee's opinion tonight, it would be the one loss to the best team in America. Certainly the team that's playing the best right now. We'll get the results tonight at 7 o'clock, and then, look, already, you know, in looking at the championship weekend, TCU is a short favorite against K-State, and in the Friday night game, the Pac-12 championship game in Vegas, SC is just a 2.5 or 3-point favorite against Utah, the team that they lost to by 1 point on a late touchdown and 2-point conversion. I give Utah and K-State real chances to win. By the way, what could change the Michigan-Georgia 1-2 situation could be Georgia losing to LSU, Michigan blowing out Purdue, obviously, or Georgia winning but not looking impressive and Michigan winning big over Purdue. Now, LSU's a better opponent than what Michigan has. So there we go. I think we've got it all figured out. The top four teams right now are obvious, and USC is the team out of the four that has to win. If they lose, they're out. TCU, it's, you know, a debatable question as to whether or not they're still in with a win. I think they would be as long as it's a close competitive win, a game they've got a chance to win in. I think everybody realizes K-State's a really good team. In fact, when the, you know, K-State's going to be, they're going to be close to the top 10. Tonight in the rankings. I guess Utah will be as well, with respect to what USC is going up against. But USC has a loss and TCU has an undefeated season. All right, I want to get to the Sean Taylor stuff. We'll do that next. By the way, phone lines open, 301-230-0980, 301-230-0980. Just your thoughts on the Sean Taylor Memorial installation, activation, as they called it, on Sunday before the game. Anything you want to say about that? Phone lines are open, 301-230-0980. Kevin Sheehan Show, Team 980, the Team 980.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medella, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medella is your reward. Medella, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Sorry about that. We are having issues once again with our phone lines. So I'm going to give you what I gave you very early in the show yesterday, kind of my thoughts on the whole Sean Taylor thing. His brother weighed in. He didn't have a problem with what happened on Sunday. His daughter found it very moving. as well. And ultimately, that really is a big part of the way I view it, and this is my opinion, is that if the family is happy, they're important, very important in this thing. But there is another and others to be considered when it comes to this. First of all, it was this. You know, some of you didn't even know this was happening. They put out the press release earlier this week, but they've been planning for this for a while. This was not the rushed retirement jersey thing last year when, you know, I forget what the story of the day was or the investigation of the week was when they put that together haphazardly in the last minute and did it very, very poorly and embarrassingly. Their plan was to honor Sean Taylor again, this time on the 15th anniversary of the day he passed away. They called this a key activation in the Sean Taylor memory, which would include the reveal of the Sean Taylor Memorial installation. It also included the launch of limited edition Sean Taylor Legacy Project merchandise and a special 21 helmet decal, which was worn by the players. The 11:45 a.m. main concourse outside of Section 132 is where they revealed this memorial installation, as they called it. I wasn't there, so I just wanted to mention, you know, perspective is everything, understood, and maybe I would feel differently, but I don't think I would have not being there. Look, to me, there is one thing that moves me emotionally, and I'll get to that in a second, but with respect to whatever that was, you know, art is subjective, understood. I just can't imagine, you know, somebody not standing up in that creative meeting, if there is one, to say, what? We're doing what? With wires and no face and just standing in Reebok pants and a Nike top. What? What are we doing? No. Let's do something that is more representative of Sean. How about somehow, if we're going to do a mannequin, let's make it him diving into the end zone like he did against Philadelphia on New Year's Day 2006, after picking up a fumble and rumbling in for what turned out to be the game-clinching score and a playoff berth. Again, I feel the same way most of you do, that whatever that was, it really was not done well. But if the family is happy with it, that's fine. I didn't expect much. My expectations are so low when it comes to them. You know, as I've mentioned so many times, I think, you know, you have an organization that, you know, regardless of regimes, is incredibly limited in so many different ways. We've felt this way about so many different things that I'm not surprised anymore when they don't, you know, plan well and then execute well on top of that. I mentioned this yesterday, and several of you reached out with all of the John McKay quotes. One of my favorite all-time quote machines was John McKay, the great coach of Southern Cal in the 70s, and then he took the Tampa Bay Buccaneers job when they became an expansion team in 1976, and they were winless for like a year and a half. And then, by the way, they turned out to be a pretty good team. They went to the NFC Championship game with Doug Williams at quarterback in 1979. I mean, that was just 3 years after they were an expansion team. But John McKay had so many great lines, like, you know, what do you think of your offense, offensive execution today? And he said, well, I'm in favor of it. But the line that McKay may have delivered about Washington and these events that they plan, they don't plan very well, but they make up for it with terrible execution. And that's basically what they do all the time. So I've come to expect that. Here's what moves me about this thing. And I say this with I hope, most of you understanding that I definitely was, you know, a Sean Taylor fan. I love the safety position in general. I considered Sean on the verge to becoming one of the all-time greats at the position, not just a franchise all-time great. That 2007 season was a breakthrough season for him. He was already at that point an excellent player on his way to becoming, I think, one of the great safeties in the history of the game. I do believe that, and I'll never forget that week 15 years ago. It was terribly, terribly tragic and sad. And so sad for not just family and friends, obviously, but for this city. And the moment before the Buffalo game that's following Sunday at FedEx Field was surreal. Never forget it, being in that stadium for that moment. I'll never forget, I was doing the pregame show with Bram Weinstein, actually, the two of us doing that, and just the incredible sadness of that week. So I, you know, I love Sean Taylor, and I recognize that, you know, there is a certain segment of the fan base that's younger primarily that looks at Sean as their guy. You know, he was their guy. I mean, there haven't been many, and it really was one of those moments, like you knew where you were when you got the news. And then for another part of the fan base, probably an older portion of the fan base, they're less enamored with the Sean Taylor years here, but terribly saddened by what happened. And I think, you know, like in my case, I certainly understood the greatness of the player, and I love the player. But my biggest, you know, takeaway from all of this, and the thing that does kind of make me, you know, a little bit angered, is I think we have to now stop with the Sean Taylor stuff. The organization needs to stop, you know, recognizing Sean Taylor. Not that we'll ever forget him. Not that there won't be other times way down the road. But it's become too much of their go-to move. And I think we all see it. It's kind of transparent, you know, and you can only go to that move so many times, you know. They don't do the move well either. Every time they do the move, there is more negative reaction to the way they've handled it than positive. And nobody wants that for Sean. But again, I defer in those specific, you know, instances in terms of reaction to the family. But for me, you know, and I know this doesn't make a lot of you happy, but I don't care. While Sean Taylor deserves to be honored by the organization in certain ways and remembered forever, for sure, there's an appropriate amount to this, and there's an appropriate order when it comes to the players that preceded him. Sean's jersey should not have been retired when it was retired. Once the organization decided to start retiring jerseys, there was an order to this. Okay, Sammy Baugh's jersey was retired and was the only one, and there were protected jerseys, and Bobby Mitchell definitely was the correct number two. But Sean should not have been the number three. You know, it should have been, you know, Sonny Jurgensen, you know, in some order, Sonny, Charlie Taylor, Daryl Green, Art Monk, John Riggins should have all had their jerseys retired before Sean's was. Look, you could make the case that Sean's jersey shouldn't have been retired. But I don't make that case. I think there's a special exception for that jersey to be retired. So I don't have a problem with the jersey being retired. I think that the jersey, it being retired, is really at the behest of the owner. And this was the owner's favorite player, and it's the go-to move for the owner multiple times now here over the last couple of years. But it should not have been the third jersey retired. And if there was going to be any sort of statue, not that they promised a statue, because they didn't. So for those of you expecting some beautiful statue, that's not what they said they were going to give you. I mean, nobody likes what they ended up providing, except for the family members, and that's fine. But if there was going to be some sort of big kind of, in, you know, glass encased whatever, it should have been for Joe Jackson Gibbs before anybody else in the history of this organization. You know, the first face sculpted on the Washington Redskins' Mount Rushmore is Joe Gibbs' face. I know how much Sean meant to so many people, and I respect that. But the organization before Sean arrived in 2004 was a winner with two NFL championships, three Super Bowl titles, many Hall of Fame players and coaches. You know, I remember Sean's moments. I do. I remember the Chicago game as a rookie wearing number 36. I remember all of the moments, and I loved him as a player. But prior to him getting here, this was an organization that won, that was classy, that was smart, that was revered, that was respected. And the number of moments and memories and players and coaches that many of us have on the 25 plus years before 2004 pale in comparison to what we've had over the last quarter century of the last 23 years. This was a different organization before Dan bought it. It's the opposite of what it is now. It won. It had classy people, smart people in the organization. It wasn't limited in so many different ways. It wasn't petty. It wasn't disrespected. It was the opposite. So, and by the way, that organization prior to Dan would have handled the Sean events much better than they've been handled. But that to me is the part, and it goes back to the jersey and the constant going to Sean on these things. I think enough is enough. And I loved Sean Taylor as a player. I'll never forget him. And I'm happy that the family is happy, because that's the most important thing. Because if they felt disrespected, or if they felt that it was, you know, poorly done, you know, then and embarrassing, which a lot of the fans, the majority of the fans seem to think, that would have been hurtful. So I hope that they are happy genuinely and honestly, because that matters a lot to me. But enough. There are so many players and coaches from a time in which this organization was a winner and a classy winner that in the appropriate order should be recognized. We've got Sonny coming up in the season finale, his jersey to be retired against the Cowboys. Let's hope that they don't butcher that somehow. Santana Moss next. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, the team980.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.